final score will be 114-89 Utah. They blow out the Lakers tonight to go to 26-6, by far the best record in the NBA this season. They're deep, they're balanced, and they're for real.
The Utah Jazz are a strange concept. Because, yeah, Utah isn't exactly a hotbed for that musical genre, but also because they're easily the best team in the league after blowing out the defending champion Lakers this week. Today, midway through the NBA season, Zach Lowe dissects what's happening in Salt Lake City and around the league from Hollywood to Brooklyn. Then, it's been just days since we explained what NBA Top Shot even is. But in the last week, hundreds of millions of real dollars have poured into these digital collectibles. So Brian Windhorst is back for more. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, February 26th. This is ESPN Daily. Zach Lowe, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, man. It's good to see you.
Zach Lowe is a senior NBA writer for ESPN and the host of the Lowe Post podcast. So you know about the NBA and basketball as much as anybody that I know on this planet. So the first question I have is the question that everybody is talking about. Have you made any investments into the world of NBA Top Shot?
You'll be shocked to know I have not. I have barely dipped my toe into the world of NBA Top Shot. My brother-in-law is asking me a lot of questions about it, to which I don't really have answers. I feel like I'm 100 years old. I don't exactly know what's going on, but I saw there was some, like, there was a Luke Kornet dunk.
Here comes Kornet.
Right down the middle of the lane.
Going for some astonishing amount of money, and everyone already agreed this could be the moment where it jumped the shark.
Yeah, I feel like me listing my Darius Garland layup for $25,000 might ensure that if Luke Kornet didn't get us there already. So we're going to have Brian Windhorst, our pal, at the end of the show to answer all of your questions. But let's get you and your brain plugged into our matrix here, because I need to understand better, Zach, where we are at the midway point of this NBA season. And that means I have questions for you about the Utah Jazz.
All right.
When I say the Utah Jazz to you right now, what comes to mind?
A whole lot of threes. They're making these every time, you know, I check a Jazz box score. My brain just like glances over 22 of 50 from three. Like, it's just nothing. They're number two in defense and number three or something in offense. They do profile as a championship contender.
Well, that's the question, Zach. Like, they're the best team in the league by record right now. Are they the best team in the league to you?
Well, the comparison that's become sort of commonplace is they're the new 60-win Hawks, the team that was built to win a lot of games in regular season. Pretty ball movement, side-to-side movement. Don't really have the star power to compete against LeBron James when it comes down to it in the playoffs. But I don't think they're just sort of like a regular season fluke.
So the way the Jazz are playing right now, it reminds me not just of the Hawks, as you said, but also a kind of mutant version of the Houston Rockets, simply because of the sheer volume of threes. Does that comparison sound at all right? And also, does that comparison then invite the questions about what happens in the postseason if shooting a bunch of threes doesn't go as well as it did in the regular season?
That comparison does not ring true to me, honestly. Just stylistically, they're so different. The volume of threes is similar. Like, they are taking a Houston Daryl Morey level volume of threes, but they play so differently. And the other comparison, Brad Stevens, I think, was the first one to give voice to this, is the 2014 Spurs, which is kind of like, that's, I don't want to say that out loud.
Well, to an NBA hipster fan, to an NBA aficionado, Zach, let's put it that way, a connoisseur, what is that specific Spurs team? What does that evoke in your memory?
It almost has this sort of religion level reverence to it.
Yes.
Everybody loved watching that team. Anybody who was at games 3 to 5 of the finals that year, when by the beginning of game four, we were all looking at each other like, oh my God, they're just going to destroy the Heat. And to compare any team to where that team reached, it just feels like talking to a pitcher in the seventh inning of a no-hitter or something. Like, you just don't want to say it out loud. But that is a comparison people are making. And look, the Jazz, their undoing in the playoffs in previous seasons was they would, very much like the Hawks, actually, they would get a lot of open threes and not make them. And you could look at that and say, well, we did everything right. We just didn't make shots, which is what every Hawks team, including that one, said after the playoffs. And so, yeah, the three-point volume is similar to the Rockets, and that's a little scary.
The team that this discussion has occurred in the context of is the Lakers, as you said, as it must be, the defending champions. And so when you look at the Lakers right now, I want to get to LeBron specifically in a second, but just them without Anthony Davis and how much they've struggled, most recently losing to these Jazz in a blowout, what is that revealing to you or confirming to you about what this team needs to actually contend?
I think like any team, they need their best players to be healthy. I'm pretty low on the Lakers panic meter because it's not just Anthony Davis who, you know, was first team all NBA last year. Anthony Davis is not like some borderline all-star that's out. He's one of the best players in the league. Dennis Schroeder is maybe their third best player. I mean, I think Kyle Kuzma has kind of claimed that mantle this year, but he might be their third most important player because he's the only other guy, with the exception of some frisky Alex Caruso games, and Talen Horton-Tucker will get you some, you know, some stuff done now and then, but he's their other on-ball creator. The other guy is a threat to score or pass to somebody else. And yeah, you take them away and it's like, oh my God, LeBron has to do everything. And you know, he's probably getting a little tired, and even though he'll never say it. And the only thing that will make my panic meter go above like 3.5 on a 1 to 10 is if we get news that Anthony Davis's injury is lingering or more serious than we thought it was or anything. If they're healthy in the playoffs, yeah, I mean, the competition in the West is probably better this year, particularly if Denver finds whatever gear they had going in the bubble. There's going to be a lot of really good teams in the West. I mean, like, you could get the one seed in the West and play the Warriors. You could get the one seed and play the Mavs. Right. I mean, it's just every round is hard there, but yeah, I can't get too worked up about it right now.
Yeah, the Western Conference meat grinder. We will contrast that to the East in a little bit, but with LeBron in specific, when you watch him, and let's take the larger, longer view on him, what this season has stuck out to you, Zach? What goes through your mind when you watch LeBron James in 2021?
Number one, the defense, he's bringing it again this year. I kind of wondered if the level of intensity he played with on defense from game one last year was going to be a one-year thing. Like we have a new coach, defensive identity. We have a new superstar, defensive identity. I'm going to set the tone for this year that this is the way we're going to play. I'm going to dial it up in a way that I have not done really since Miami.
Yeah.
And then we won the title, and we know what we can do, and we know what we can be. And like, let's just like call me in the playoffs. And he's played pretty damn hard again on defense this year, which is really impressive. And the other thing is just sort of the sheer, you have these moments during every Lakers game when you watch him do his left to right spin, or, you know, score four straight buckets in the post in crunch time when they have nothing else going on. When you just sort of sit back and sort of marvel at, like, how many times have I watched this movie? I'm still watching this movie, and I've seen it a million times. I'm not tired of it. It's just, I can't believe he's still able to do this. Like, he's earned beyond every benefit of the doubt. I mean, like, I don't know. He's the best player. We know he's the best player. If he wins the MVP, it will be because we all have this sort of cognitive realization deep down. Like, he's the best player. The last couple of years, we gave it to the other guy who had the best stats and looked like the best regular season player, and they didn't do very well in the playoffs.
So the other thing LeBron James always is, beyond being the best player, is the player whose voice matters the most. And we saw him employ that voice this week, saying Devin Booker, the most disrespected player in our league, 3 exclamation points, simple as that, period. And soon thereafter, Devin Booker is picked to replace Anthony Davis on that All-Star team. Zach, what did you make of that whole news cycle about Devin Booker?
Typically, the league office just follows the voting. They've taken the power of choice out of Adam Silver's office. He just goes down the line, who's the next guy he's in. You're saving me writing this in my column, so thank you for this.
You are welcome.
So LeBron should be required to say, A, who's disrespecting him? The coaches made the picks. The coaches, including your head coach. You should ask Frank Vogel, did you pick Devin Booker?
Did you disrespect Devin Booker?
And Frank second Vogel? Of all, you know what would be really disrespectful? If LeBron James were required by Twitter law to tweet which of the 12 Western Conference All-Stars he's taking off to make room for Devin Booker. Because I say this every year. My guy got snubbed. It's outrageous this guy's not on. Okay, who are you taking off? There's 12 spots. I thought Devin Booker, he didn't make my fake All-Star team. He was guy 13 or 14. I love Devin Booker. I've been hoarding Devin Booker stock since way before it was cool. It's really hard to make the Western Conference. There's a reason Mike Conley has made no All-Star teams. It's really hard to make it in the West.
By the way, I am in support of the Zach Lowe amendment to Twitter law, 1,000,000%. When you look at the Suns and Chris Paul and Devin Booker and how good they are you optimistic about what they can do this season?
I think they're a tier below the top three, and I think they're a tier below Denver. If Denver can ever get healthy, they've had health and safety protocols issues, but a lot of it's going to depend on seedings. Like, they could win a round if they were to beat Utah or one of the LA teams in the second round. I'd be pretty surprised. I think you give those teams a decently competitive series, but the Suns are good. They're really good.
So on your MVP ballot, which is not going to be fictional by the end of this year, Zach.
But currently is fictional.
What does it look like?
I did this last week, and I had Embiid number one by a tiny bit over Jokic and LeBron. I think those are the clear top three, and I had Kawhi four and Curry five. Well, I think I'd probably keep that the same. I mean, I'm a Damian Lillard true believer.
I feel bad for Dame. I know he has millions of dollars, also like many good things going for him, but it does feel like perpetually, Zach, we do have to make that doff of the cap to be like, Damian Lillard, I'm sorry for mentioning you like as the fifth name in any conversation.
I've had him on my official real MVP ballot the last 2 years and maybe the last three. I can't remember. Now, he's been fifth, but I mean, it's hard to make an MVP ballot.
Exactly.
It's really hard to do. I think I probably would tip Jokic above Embiid now a week later by a tiny bit. I don't know if you saw any of the Sixers-Raptors games this week. Those games are the argument against Embiid, because all Toronto did was like, we're throwing three dudes at you and we're not letting you dominate the game, and he couldn't really dominate the game.
All right, Zach, you are wearing a Sixers hat. You are speaking Sixers heresy. So after the break, we're going to dive deeper into Philly and the Nets and what exactly is happening in the Eastern Conference.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine. Especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way, or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Zach, we are in the Eastern Conference now. It is a bizarre place to be. I'm wondering if you are surprised by how middling it is, because there are three teams precisely above 500, the Sixers, Nets, and Bucks in that order. And then there's a bunch of the cool kids, and they're all kind of jumbled together, 6 through 10, basically. Is all of this about what you expected, or are you surprised?
I think you can even go 6 to 13. I mean, The Wiz are only a game out in the loss column of 10th, which means the play-in now.
Right.
And then you have the drop-off to Cleveland and Detroit. I mean, I thought this season would be pretty weird once it was clear how many guys were going to be in and out of the lineup. Like, Miami is much better than their record. Toronto, I think, will come on. I didn't think the Celtics would slip this far. But you look at team by team, there are not that many outcomes on the negative side that are that shocking when you realize how many guys have been out. But it's like just a morass. I can't even keep track of the standings anymore.
So the Celtics, as the team that you called out there, that's where I wanted to go next, because this is the team, Zach, that made the Eastern Conference Finals last year and the year before that. And they are sub 500. They've lost 14 of 24. I'm seeing columns by reputable people who are accusing them of looking like they're giving up in games against teams like the Hawks most recently. So how worried should people in Boston be about the way the Celtics are looking as of February 25th?
I think pretty worried. Now, let's step back. Gordon Hayward left for a trade exception. The trade exception cannot appear in any basketball games. Trade exception doesn't play. There is no human trade exception.
If only.
And that was, I think, an underrated loss among Celtics fans. Just his secondary playmaking, his shooting, you know, they would kill to have that dude on their team right now. Kemba has been a shell of himself until the last week or so and missed half the season. Marcus Smart is injured. Okay, so you take all that. You really just have too many guys who can't do anything on offense around the two all-star players. And they're really suffering for it. Their offense is like 20th or 21st in the league right now. And that was my primary point of concern for them coming into the season, is that they were a top six or seven offense last year. And I didn't think they could carry that over. I didn't think they'd be this bad. And stylistically, it's ugly, man. It's not fun to watch. They go one-on-one a lot. They don't particularly score well out of isolations. And then they have these spurts where they get into some more cooperative actions. The ball moves a little bit more. And it makes you think, once they get all their players available and healthy, I do think they'll hit a groove where they look better. Kemba, Smart, Jalen, and Jason, that's the foursome that carried them almost to the finals last year, right? So there is reason to think, well, why can't they do it again? But something is not quite right with them, and I don't look at them right now as a threat to like get out of the East or anything like that.
So people in Philly then taking particular pleasure in seeing how the Boston Celtics are looking, but they also, those people in Philly, just grew infuriated at you, Zach, because of what you said at the end of our last segment, which I must admit did worry me when I was seeing how the Raptors were playing the Sixers. So the case against Joel Embiid as MVP, and therefore the case against the Sixers as the clear favorite in the Eastern Conference, is what?
Well, let me be clear to the Sixers fans who are angry, okay? I picked Joel Embiid as my MVP like 6 days
ago.
Don't
try to reason okay? with them, Zach.
So the primary case against Joel Embiid as MVP is Nikola Jokic is amazing and putting up one of the greatest statistical seasons of all time, and also the most fun player to watch in the NBA. And LeBron James is LeBron James.
Philly as a whole, though, Zach, when you see how they're constructed, and now we're familiar with this team, it's a revived Tobias Harris, it's Danny Green, it's Seth Curry, it's shooters, it's fit better. Ben Simmons has played better, a Defensive Player of the Year candidate, my beloved Australian large adult son. What is the skepticism about the Sixers as a whole?
I think the skepticism is that, again, like, who's creating offense other than Embiid late in games, right? Like, the record is out. Simmons has not done much of that. Tobias Harris, he's a good player. Do I really trust him? And there's like a huge amount of Seth Curry going on in crunch time.
So much Seth Curry.
And I think all of us, like, Sixers, like, I now include myself as part of like the Sixers obsessives at this point. We're so sort of exuberant about just them adding shooting, anybody who could shoot, that I think we got, like, when you actually looked at it, it's like, okay, Danny Green probably like should be a backup now on a great team. Seth Curry has been mostly a backup in his NBA career. Good backup, but mostly a backup. And you just started to feel like, I wonder if in the exuberance over just their skill sets, we're overrating them to a degree as players. And so it's just sort of a talent question to me. Is there quite enough juice there?
So I'm shoveling all of that coal into the furnace of my heart, and I'll remember this as the playoffs begin. But I need to pivot to the team that a lot of people think is actually the favorite in the Eastern Conference now, which is James Harden's Brooklyn Nets. And they have, Zach, self-evidently, as much talent as we've seen on a single team, maybe in NBA history. Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Kevin Durant, and they've been doing what they've been doing without Kevin Durant. So what are you learning about the Nets as you watch them on this run that they've been on, which has been admittedly incredible and also to date undefeated?
Yeah, I think the Nets are the clear favorites in the East now. This is what we kind of expected, right? Like, an unbelievable offensive team. I said, even before they traded for Harden, I said people were overblowing the there's only one ball criticism or concern. Like, they're just so amazing offensively that they will figure it out. Durant is maybe the greatest amplifier of other superstars in the history of the NBA. And they haven't, like you said, they haven't even had him in the last X amount of days, whatever
it's
it is.
Crazy.
The three of them have only played like 170 minutes together total since the Harden trade. It's not much at all. And I think really what you're learning is that Steve Nash is going to be a pretty adventurous coach in terms of how he's going to use the regular season to try out different lineups, different starting lineups. Sometimes they've done the thing where they start games based on matchups. They don't just have a, this is our starting five. And I think that's the most interesting part, is sort of how Steve plays around with what he's got.
So if you're making the case against the Nets, then, as I personally would like you to do. Is that premised on the psychoanalysis, the chemistry experiment stuff, the personality concerns? Where does the skepticism draw from for the Nets?
The personality stuff has been pretty quiet, honestly. Like, I haven't heard much coming out of there. There hasn't been much coming out of there. I think the skepticism is where we all think it is, which is mostly defense, but not just defense. So just as like an example, the Bucks have Giannis, Middleton, and Holiday. Three pretty capable defenders to guard the Nets guys. Now, what the Nets are banking on is we've essentially collected so much offensive talent as to render the other team's defense completely irrelevant. Like, these guys are unstoppable. You cannot stop all of them in the same game, no matter who your three defensive players are. Maybe they're right. Let's say the Bucks manage to slow them down just enough, or the Celtics, although I just said the Celtics are not in it, but they have Tatum, Brown, and Marcus Smart. Like, if you throw three guys out there who have at least a fighting chance without flooding double teams, if you slow them down just enough that they actually have to play some defense to win the game, do they have some defense in them? I think that's really the only question, and I don't know what level of defense that's going to have to be, because you may not be able to slow them down. I mean, that collection of individual shot creation is essentially unprecedented in the history of the NBA.
So let's pivot now across the river, because I do want to land this podcast, where we tend to land our conversations, Zach, more often than not, on something about the New York Knicks. Knicks fans, I feel like, have this truly insane and delusional excitement about a team that is scrolling to the 10th slot in the Eastern Conference standings, 15-17. What's the forecast, Zach? You're a meteorologist now. You're a basketball meteorologist. Describe what the skies look like for Knicks fans as we round into the second half.
Their offense is really bad, and their defense is pretty good. And sort of you've meshed those two things together. And on nights when Julius Randle turns into Steph Curry somehow, and RJ Barrett makes some jumpers, they're going to win. And on nights when those things don't happen, they're going to lose, and they're going to come out of the wash as like a, you know, slightly below 500 or 500-ish team. It's a boring forecast, but that's what they are. What was Stringer's line? A 40-degree day? This is like a 40-degree. It's just okay. What was the point of the 40-degree day monologue? Was it a bad thing or a good thing? I can't remember in The Wire.
I recall there being a lot of complexity in The Wire that I didn't totally understand at the time and failed to still today.
That's like a 40-degree day. Ain't nobody got nothing to say about a 40-degree day.
Yeah, Zach, I have the quote from The Wire on my screen right now, and I can't read any of it to you on a podcast, but I think the general gist is nobody really remembers 40-degree days.
Nobody give a about 40. Nobody remember 40. Just giving me way too many 40-degree days. What
the? I'm going to go back and watch it, because I'm now, if there's that much profanity especially, I'm excited. I'm excited to watch it.
Zach Lowe, thank you for letting us invade your brain, and thank you for giving that much hope to the city of New York.
I want the Knicks to be good. So I'm happy for Knicks fans, and thank you as always for having me. It's always a good time.
Always.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Last week, our pal Brian Windhorst joined us to explain what in the hell NBA Top Shot actually is.
It is a digital collectible digital meaning not tangible, doesn't physically exist, exists only on the internet. And they are video clips of varying lengths of NBA players doing things, passing the ball for assists, blocking shots, dunking, doing anything it is that NBA players do.
So cut to the past few days as we've watched the marketplace for videos of NBA players doing things rocket to and then past the moon, brushing past Mars, I believe, most recently. Now, I would be lying if I told you that we here at ESPN Daily didn't want to claim at least some credit for all of this. So we made sure to call Brian back to check in on basketball's crypto collectible boom before it busts. So, Brian, how would you even begin to describe what's happened to NBA Top Shot since we last talked?
It has absolutely blown me away. I have never seen anything like it in my career. I have never been involved in a story of a trend like this in my career, and I'm somebody who likes to write about trends.
I mean, Brian, you were, whether you liked it or not, you used to be the LeBron guy. Now you're the NBA Top Shot guy, and it's your job to make sense of all of this for everybody.
Yeah, so I think that we spoke for the first time 7 days ago,
yes,
give or take. In those 7 days, Top Shot has done, as of this moment, $145 million in sales. Just to put that in perspective, all time, they've done $230 million in sales.
Man.
That's an extraordinary acceleration. Terry Rozier, earlier this week, guard for the Charlotte Hornets, started offering courtside tickets and autographed jerseys and other perks for people who would buy his moment. And I don't know if that was because he owned it and was trying to make a profit or if he was just really into it. I'm not sure, but the NBA players have embraced it now, and it's like pouring gasoline on a roaring fire.
Yeah, as someone who just spent $24 to buy a Nerlens Noel block, I feel like Nerlens really got to step up his game, man. If Terry Rozier's out here doing that, Nerlens needs to do his customer base a little bit better.
Yeah, and you know, there's obviously incredible speculation going on here. And you know, I've had some people who I trust who have looked into the blockchain ledger on it. And there's some evidence clearly of some bots doing high frequency buying and selling and driving up the prices. It's hard to know what is, it's all legitimate sales. We know that the sales all exist because it's on the blockchain, but it's hard to know how much of this is real and true and how much of this is a function of a wild market. I mean, basically, Pablo, this is in some ways a derivative market. It's not exactly like buying a credit default swap on a mortgage bond, but it's not completely out of the same ballpark. I mean, it is something that was created out of whole cloth, in this case, out of, you know, ones and zeros. But that doesn't mean it's not something that can have staying power, because at the end of the day, you know, a Picasso, not everybody can afford to buy it, but there are, you know, some multiples of people that want them. And as long as those people want them, its value will always be extraordinarily high. And that could be the case. It's been the case for the sports card market for decades. And we could be at the beginning of something that is a new legacy collectible.
But in the sports card market, it's also the case that that trajectory has had peaks and valleys. Right now, certainly, there is a peak coinciding with the pandemic, coinciding with a lot of people with money getting back into it, parallel to Top Shot. But you mentioned credit default swaps, Brian, and that brings to mind this concern that you had alluded to earlier that maybe this isn't entirely stable. You got to wait 30 days to get your money back. You have concerns about people selling to their friends back and forth. What are the concerns that you've heard that sit at the forefront of your mind?
When I wrote my story, I was aware of the issues with some of the account withdrawals. And it's really important to point out that the secondary marketplace for almost all of these cards exists within Top Shot's market. So, you know, if you buy and sell a card a whole bunch of times and you rack up $50,000 or $100,000, it's sitting on their books. And for you to get it, they have to give it to you. being told you have to wait 30 days for your money in 2021 is very concerning. And I think, like with anything, whether it's with Beanie Babies or Cabbage Patch Kids or, when a new enterprise is overrun with popularity, there's growing pains. And, you know, that's definitely the case right now with some of the aspects of Top Shot. And then again, you are concerned about, these bots. And you know, somebody showed me a Joel Embiid moment that was bought and sold, seven or eight times in a 10-minute period, each time increasing it. Again, all of those sales could potentially be legitimate, but it seems like there's a computer acting as that. So, but that said, like, the one thing I will say is that the alternative to that is that there are very real people who are influencers, like NBA players, like other people who talk about on social media, like yourself or other people who really are excited about this.
Yeah. What's your sense as to how often guys in the league are talking about this? Because there is not just the intrigue about the concept, but there's also like money for them in the larger pot that the deal was made with the union.
For sure. So, just in general, the more money that Top Shot collects in fees, the more money comes back to the players and the league through the licensing deals that they have. What I think I've noticed from players is over the last like 7 to 10 days, a curiosity of what is this? What's going on here? And them educating each other, like one guy finding out and then telling another guy about it. And then the next layer of guys like, hey, I kind of like this. Let me try to get this. And so I do think it's fascinating. We also have new record sales. When we talked a week ago, the record sale was 100,000. It's now 208,000.
What got 208,000?
It was a LeBron James moment.
The Picasso of the NBA.
Right. For the moment, Pablo, I mean, you know, you see how popular LeBron is. I think LeBron is, as we speak, I mean, it's changing by the hour. I think LeBron's moments have been like 6 or 7 of the top 10 sales. But as we talked about last week, the NBA told me that they want to make their historical content available eventually. Yeah. Can you imagine when the Kobe and Jordan stuff potentially comes out, especially if it's limited form? I think LeBron could be pushed to the back seat.
I feel like the next step is the historical vault. It's, I don't know, selling like digital picture frames with serial numbers so you could display and play these moments in real life. I feel like that is a possibility.
Would you put one on your wall? Because that's the thing. Like, there's a couple of different types of memorabilia collectors. There's some people who want a Kobe Bryant signed jersey. They put it in a frame and they put it in their man cave in the basement, and it will stay there for 25 or 30 years. There are other people who are in the game specifically to buy, sell, and trade.
For me, Brian, I gotta say, I would have thought that I was a casual here. But yesterday, I hit a real crossroads in my life. It was 5 p.m. Eastern. I discovered suddenly that there was a new NBA Top Shot drop, meaning that thing when the internet all rushes to be one of the first 5,000 people who can spend $9 on a pack of 3 random videos.
Right.
The problem, Brian, was that 5 p.m. Eastern was also the time of my daughter's first birthday party on Zoom. I tried to do both. My wife wasn't thrilled that the camera was watching my face be very stressed about being number 70,652 in line.
And there was probably quite a few people behind you.
Yes. And Brian, to be clear, you still have an empty portfolio on NBA Top Shot, or are you in this game now?
I am not in the game. You know, I am a conservative investor. I am more like Warren Buffett in that
regard. Your fellow Nebraskan.
But that's probably why I don't fly private. You know, when I had started reporting this story a month ago, had I bought some, it's very clear to me that I could have made hundreds, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. But it's not my nature to do that.
Well, it is mine, so if anybody wants to buy my Bismack Biyombo layup, I'm currently charging $50,000.
I wish you luck in that regard.
Brian Winters, thank you for being our spirit guide through NBA Top Shot.
And good luck, Pablo. May you get into that 5,000 for the next common pack.
Amen. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Troh, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andres Soto, Sania Blue, Jackson Ugello, George Milkov, and Troy Farkas. Good luck in Denver, Troy. I'll talk to you Monday.